I appreciate your coming. We are here tonight to have a seminar of three sessions on life after death, or evidence for immortality. I'm sure you're here because, in the first place, as Christians, and most of us are, we all have a lifelong interest in this subject. But in addition to that, many of you are here because you have lost loved ones, and you'd like to know a little more about what to expect when you go yourself. Now, there are those who always ask us, why do you have seminars on death? Doom and gloom we don't like. Wouldn't it be better to have a seminar on life? Well, frankly, that's what this is going to be. It is a seminar on life after death. But we cannot begin to understand life in the world to come until we first of all recognize that death is the means by which we enter that life. In other words, in order to get to heaven, you have to cross the earth. And to cross the earth means that sometimes you have to suffer, go through great pain, loneliness, and eventually we all die if Jesus tarries his coming. The world is a mortal place. And none of us will get out of this world alive. It's a chaotic place. All you have to do is pick up the newspaper or turn on the news on television and watch the wars and the homicides and the wickedness across the earth. Visit the hospitals, go to the mortuary, and you're constantly reminded that we live in a world that is dying. And so we've come tonight recognizing that while Easter is the most wonderful festival of the Christian year, you do not get to Easter until you go through Good Friday. Some have suggested that the favored season of the year is Christmas. I doubt that, because without Easter, Christmas would really have no meaning at all. Now you need to know at the outset that these addresses are not sermons. I am not preaching in these seminar lectures. They are lectures, and I am attempting to inform or instruct about the subject which we have chosen. It is true that Easter is just around the corner, and all of us feel a great deal of anticipation when Easter arrives. We wait during the week of Passion for that glorious festival of the Christian year, because the winter's gone, and the spring has now begun, and life has taken on new color, and all around us we see the warmth of growing things, and we are filled with an accent of joy. I remember a number of years ago, in fact it's been many, many years ago, about 36. In 1966 I lost a loved one who was very close to me. Just before Easter, about 5 weeks before Easter, and on Easter Sunday morning that year, I made the trek to the crypt where her body lay. And I stood there at the crypt and tried to talk with her in my own way. And I wept. And I was a little embarrassed that I would weep. And yet I remembered that even Jesus wept at the grave of Lazarus. But when I wept that day, I did not weep as one who has no hope. I knew in my heart that Easter had to be so. All my life I had believed in the story of Easter. But that Easter Sunday, I knew that I no longer believed in Easter, that I knew Easter had to be so. And I recognized too as I stood there that my tears were really unwarranted. We are human enough that we cannot avoid that, but they are unwarranted. And that is why when Mary and the women came to the tomb of Jesus on that first Easter Sunday morning, the angel in the open doorway of the tomb said to her, "Why are you weeping? There is no reason to weep when one dies in the faith, because we know where that person is." Now, as I look into your faces tonight, I am aware that some of you are recently bereaved. Some of you have been bereaved just days or weeks or months. Some of you have been bereaved for years. And it doesn't really matter how long it's been, because your heart still hurts and you feel lonely, and you wait for the day of final reunion. When I was a much younger man, I used to hide my head in the sand when people talked about death. I didn't want to think about it. I certainly didn't want to talk about it. And yet today, as I grow older, I find myself thinking about it a lot and talking about it a lot. Because back then, my death seemed to be so far away that it was insignificant. In my prime, I still had 20, 30, maybe even 40 years, and it was a long way off. But now, every morning, I look at the obituaries. I used to never look at the obituaries. I look at them to see if my friends are still alive. And I discover quite often that some of my friends who are my age have slipped away. And I say to my wife probably twice every week, "Do you mean it's Friday already? How the time is flying." When I was 16 years old, time moved at a snail's pace. And now it goes so fast, I wish it would slow down. A while back, I was in Florida, and I met a friend of mine of many years. And I said to him, "W.A., how are you? It is so good to see you." And he said to me, "I think I am fine, but I am 84 years old, and pretty soon I'm going to heaven." Joseph Addison remarks, "When I am in a serious humor, I often walk by myself in Westminster Abbey." If you've ever been to Westminster Abbey, you know what he means. It is a place of quietness, a very somber place, because many of the great kings and philosophers and poets of England are buried in Westminster Abbey. Some time ago, I was at Bruton Parish Church in Williamsburg. Some of you have been there. An old, old church which is still holding services after all these many years since the Revolutionary War. I walked through the cemetery with my wife, and I saw those graves, many of them in shambles, they had been there so long. And I saw on the headstones, in letters and words which were still fairly legible, the names of some people I remembered or recognized. I saw also the names of many people I did not know. Just a couple of years ago, I was in Savannah, and I went over to the old city cemetery in Savannah, where many of the Civil War people are buried. The cemetery is now closed to any new bodies. It is full. And as I walked through the Savannah cemetery and again looked at the stones, I saw the names of some of the famous men of the battles of the Civil War. But I saw many, many stones on which were the names of people of whom I had never heard. Death, you see, is the ultimate statistic. One out of one dies. It is appointed unto men once to die, says the Bible. And Ecclesiastes reminds us that there is a time to be born and there is a time to die. And the pessimist says we live to die, but the optimist says we die to live. It all depends on how you look at life. It all depends on whether the cup is half full or half empty. I remember many years ago when the sultra Peggy Lee used to sing a love song. And in that love song, she repeated happily some of the experiences she could remember in her life, the loves she had had, the joys, the pleasant experiences she had had. And then as she came to the end of the song, refrain-like, again and again, she asked, "Is that all there is?" Some of us, when we stand at an open grave, are tempted to ask, "Is that all there is?" And there's some who say, yes, that's all there is. But if in this life only we have hope, we are of all men most miserable. Cicero went down to the necropolis, which was the place of the dead, and he stood in anguish at his daughter's grave, and he said, "Is this the quenching of thy life, O my daughter?" And Job, when he was facing his own death, after going through great suffering, asked the question, if a man die, will he live again? And when his three friends came to comfort him, they didn't bother to answer that question. They really had no answer for it. Life after death, the thought trembles with hope when we stand by an open grave. And there's some who insist that immortality is a false hope. It's an idle tale, that there is no reason. We have no logical reason for believing it. Epicurus argued that because there is nothing after this life, we should eat, drink, and be merry, because, as he said, tomorrow we die. And it was Zeno, the founder of the Stoics, who said, life is so meaningless and there's nothing beyond it, so meaningless that we should just clench our fist against the pain and endure it and face the bleakness. George Bernard Shaw, whose name you all recognize, once said, the worst thing I can think of is for Shaw to go on forever. I suppose that George Bernard Shaw was having a bad day when he made that statement, because I can't imagine anybody thinking that the worst thing that could happen to him would be to go on forever, unless he had a very low esteem of himself. One day I called at the funeral home where a minister friend of mine lay in state, and as I walked into the funeral home, his wife said to me, he deserved to die. Now, had I not known her, I might have thought she was glad to get rid of him or that he was a bad character. But I knew what she was saying. She was saying he was such a wonderful Christian man that he deserved to die. What a different way of looking at death than that of George Bernard Shaw. Well, Shaw lived to be 94 years old and died in 1950. And he died feeling that his life was utter uselessness, one that was cast upon the waste heaps. H.G. Wells is another one whom you remember. He said emphatically, man who began in a cave behind a windbreak will end in the soaked ruins of a slum. Well, I don't particularly agree with that. When I laid my wife to rest in 1966, and when I later laid my father to rest in 1978, and later laid my mother to rest, I knew in my heart that a 6-foot mound of clay was not their final resting place. So fair a spirit would not be destined to spend forever in that grave. And yet some of us throw our loved ones away when they die, not because we don't love them anymore, but because it's all over so far as we know. Yet I expect my loved ones to be recycled. I think I am going to be recycled. In fact, that's what the resurrection is. It is God's great recycling day, because God never discards anything that he has made. Swinburne was an agnostic. He was a philosopher, but he was a very depressing man. He is known in history as the father of pessimism. He was always negative and always filled with melancholy. Listen to what he wrote. We thank with brief thanksgiving, whatever gods may be, that no man lives forever, that dead men rise up never, that even the weariest river winds somewhere to the sea. By which he is saying, it's all over when you die. You're just swallowed up into oblivion like the river disappears when it merges with the sea. He continues, then star nor sun shall waken, nor any change of light, nor sound of waters shaken, nor any sound or sight, nor wintry leaves nor vernal, nor days nor things diurnal, only the sleep eternal in an eternal night. Now, it took me 60 seconds to read that bit of foolish philosophical nonsense. Lay it aside, because Swinburne is talking about something of which he knew absolutely nothing at all. He was such a dismal man, such a meaningless person, that the story is told that one day he was sitting on a park bench. He had an old paper sack open He had eaten part of his meager lunch. He was dressed in tatters. His hair was awry. His face was dirty. His shoes were thin-soled. And a policeman, thinking that he was a derelict, said to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I wish I knew." Later, Swinburne insists, "No man under the sky lives twice, outliving his day." Now, even the Hindus would disagree with that, because the Hindus believe that we all come back. We do live a second time. The trouble with Hinduism is that it advocates the idea that we live the third time, and the fourth, and the fifth, and as long as it takes for us to get the thing done right. This is what we call the doctrine of reincarnation. Of course, you understand that there is some truth in that. We find here a perversion of the doctrine of the resurrection. Christianity disagrees also with Swinburne because Christianity says we go on. And please note that the distinctive difference between Hinduism and Christianity is Hinduism says we come back, Christianity says we go on, which means we never die. We live forever. Once you start, you never stop. Isn't that what Paul was talking about when he said, unless a grain of corn be dropped into the ground and die, it cannot bear fruit? The grain of corn must die before it can produce the fullness of itself. And so it was when Jesus was buried in that sepulcher on Good Friday. He was the first fruits of the kingdom. He was like a grain that had been cast into the earth. And on resurrection morning, he came forth to show us that this is what the harvest will be for all of us. Not a bare grain cast into the soil where it rots away, but rather the germ of life within that bare grain which produces not one kernel, but a full ear upon the vine. Louis Pasteur sat by the bedside of his dying daughter, and he said, and remember, Louis Pasteur was a scientist, a naturalist. He said, "I know only scientifically determined truth, but I'm going to believe what I want to believe, what I cannot help but believe. I expect to meet this dear child in another world." Now, the striking words of Pasteur, the scientist, in that statement are these words, "I cannot help but believe." And so it is. Do you remember Robert Ingersoll? Robert Ingersoll was an avowed infidel. He rejected belief in God. He rejected belief in the afterlife. And yet when he stood by the grave of his brother and gave a eulogy for one whom he had loved and lost, he said, "Life is a narrow veil between the cold and barren peaks of two eternities. We strive in vain to see beyond the heights. We cry aloud, and only the murmur is the echo of our wailing cry. From the voiceless lips of the unreplying dead, there comes no word." Now that sounds like Robert Ingersoll. That's what he believed. He was a man of total despair, and yet in the midst of his eulogy, he stops and adds these words, "But in the night of death, hope sees a star, and listening can hear the rustling of a wing." You see, the premise upon which he had built his philosophy, the logic which he had lived by all his life as an agnostic or an infidel, broke down. It didn't hold up when he stood by the grave of his brother. Now, it's suggested by some that hope in the life to come is a subjective thing. We have no empirical evidence. That is, we have no evidence that can be given to us from the laboratory. And indeed, the laboratory doesn't offer us a reason to believe because we've never seen anything under the microscope or anything in a test tube which would make us believe that there is life after death. But for that matter, we've never seen anything under the microscope or in the test tube that would make us believe that love is a reality. And yet love is something all of us experience and know to be not subjective, but objective. No one's ever returned from the grave, we are told. Well, is that right? Leslie Weatherhead was a preacher in London, England, about 50 years ago. In fact, he was the pastor for a number of years of one of the large congregational churches in London. He was pastor of City Temple Methodist Church. He was a congregationalist, but he was pastor of that large Methodist church. He wrote a number of books. One of his books is a big theological tome with a lot of footnotes and documents called Psychology, Religion, and Healing. And in that book, he tells us about his experiments in dealing with the dead. Not the kind of experiments which you and I go through, but something totally different. He had been to seances. He had talked with mediums. He had discussed this matter with psychics. And he had fully decided that the paranormal idea of life after death and speaking or communicating with those who had died was true. A number of years later, I met his son, Dr. John Weatherhead, who was the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Cleveland Clinic. And as I talked with him, I said, "Do you know anything about how your father advanced in his thoughts about speaking with the dead?" And he hung his head for a moment, and then he said to me, "Well, let me tell you a story." He said, "Shortly before my father died, he said to my daughter, 'Here is a half of a saucer. I have broken this plate in half. I'm going to bury half of it and give the other half to you. And after I'm gone, I will come back and I will tell you where the other half of the saucer is.'" I said, "That's been a number of years, hasn't it? Because he's been dead a long time." "Oh, yes." Well, I said, "Whatever happened?" And he said, tongue in cheek, "Well, we haven't heard from Father yet. No one has ever returned." Omar Khayyam muses, "Strange, is it not, that of the myriads who before us passed the door of darkness through, not one returns to tell us of the road, which to discover we must travel to." But I ask the question, is it true that no one has ever returned? It seems to me that I remember there was one who did return and who said to his disciples, "Behold my hands and my feet, for it is I." And it seems to me that I recall that he said, "Yes, you do know now the way, for I am the way, the truth, and the life." Now it's an obvious fact that natural science believes that our belief in life after death is a fantasy. But the natural science believes the virgin birth is a fantasy. Natural science believes the miracles of Jesus were a fantasy. Natural science believes the creation of the world by God is a fantasy. And so you see, we do not necessarily need empirical evidence to believe in something. What we need is common sense proof. And it's so much easier to believe that the universe was created by a divine mind than it is to believe that the universe just came to be by sheer accident. Remember that it was the intellectuals who said man will never fly. And remember that the Wright brothers proved them wrong. Remember that it was the intellectuals who said man will never drive faster than 60 miles an hour or he would suffocate. Well, if no one else proved them wrong, my teenage sons at the age of 16 all proved them wrong. The intellectual said you will never live with somebody else's heart or lungs or liver, but they have been proved wrong. The intellectuals have said you will not live forever, but now some of them are changing their minds. Oh, it's been a number of years ago that some of them had decided maybe they could freeze the human body and keep it frozen until they discovered a cure for the disease and then bring it back. That's not happened, but they were working on it. And some of them now think that maybe they can provide human immortality for the human race by cloning. God knew all about cloning long before they did. It's dangerous, don't you see, to outthink God or even try, because you can deny God all you want, but you cannot outthink God. That's why Hamlet said to Horatio, "More things in heaven and earth than you ever dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio." Immortality is a universal expectation. I don't know any race or clime of people in past history or prehistory who did not believe in some kind of life after death. It's a built-in certainty with us. It just comes with us when we're born. The Egyptians, you remember, put food and servants and animals and vehicles in the tomb with their loved ones when they died. They embalmed their bodies because they believed that their loved one would need that body in the next world and would need those vehicles and those animals and that food and those servants in the world to come. The Egyptians believed in life after death. And the Teutons of Germany and the Norsemen of Scandinavia, they believe that when we die, we go to Valhalla. Some of the golf courses today are called Valhalla. We go to Valhalla, which means we enjoy the spacious green of those fields and we enjoy festive food with the gods forever. And the American Indians, they believed in a great spirit. And they believed that there was a happy hunting ground where they went when they died. And if you go to primitive Africa today, or go to India, or to Arabia, you will find that everybody has some concept of life after death. The five major religions of the world, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, those are the five major religions, the only religions that really are outstanding today. In the five major religions of the world, there is in each of them some concept of life after death. In fact, in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, there's a strong belief in the resurrection of the dead for all three of those doctrinal views. In Hinduism, there is life after death through reincarnation, which I've mentioned earlier. And in Buddhism, while there is no specific kind of life after death, when one dies, he goes to nirvana, which is a wonderful place in which he merges with the soul of the universe. And in every instance, whether it is any one of those religions and their advocates, in all cases, these people live with a kind of tiptoe expectancy about what is going to happen to them when they die. Walt Whitman observed, "The world, the race, the soul, in space and time, the universe, all bound as is befitting each, all surely going somewhere." Isn't that what the writer of Hebrews means when he says of Abraham, he sojourned in a land not knowing where he went, but looking for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And I think all of us anticipate such a thing as we make our journey through the shadows of the world. Some say that the Old Testament has no evidence or gives no evidence of immortality, but that's incorrect. Let me give you some scriptures out of the Old Testament before Jesus rose from the dead, which advocate, underwrite the view of life after death. Oftentimes, and I'm not giving you a scripture for this because it's mentioned numerous times, but oftentimes in the Old Testament, the statement is made of a patriarch when he dies, that he was gathered to his people. What that expression, gathered to his people, means is not that he was buried in the family plot. It means that he was gathered to his people. It means that he had life everlasting somewhere, though the Hebrews at that time did not have that concept fully developed. And then in Psalm 16, "For thou wilt not leave my soul in Sheol," which was the grave, "neither wilt thou permit thy Holy One to see corruption," a direct reference to the coming Messiah. But the Messiah was to be a human being, God's representative, and they were sure that the Messiah would live forever. Likewise, he would share his foreverness with them. Psalm 17, "I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in thy likeness." Psalm 73, "I am continually with thee. Thou hast holden me by thy counsel, and afterward, in the next world, receive me into glory." And Job said, "After my skin worms have destroyed this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." That's the nearest thing we can come to resurrection in the Hebrew Old Testament. And Isaiah 26, thy dead shall live, with my dead body shall they arise, the words of the prophet. And Daniel 12, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Sounds very much like the teaching of the New Testament. And of course, the New Testament is replete with teachings about life after death. And to sum it up, I would turn to 2 Timothy chapter 1, where the writer says, Christ hath abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. And to bring light to immortality through the gospel means that the task of the church is to do simply that, to enlighten people about life after death. Because before the coming of Christ, and even since the coming of Christ, with masses of people in the world, this is still a shadowy sort of thing. And the church has been called to share this new truth, this new clarity about life after death with the world. Now, I would say to you that human creation must have a future. It must have a future for five reasons. First of all, because of the supremacy of God. God will not allow the annihilation of anything which he has made unless he annihilates it. Therefore, we have reason to believe that God's masterpiece, man, will be kept forever by his sovereign power. Also, the justice of God demands that we have a future. I think the justice of God says that there will be a balance in the life to come between what sin has done to us here and what redemption has done for us in Jesus Christ. The holiness of God demands life after death, because a good God would not will something that is bad. And the wisdom of God demands life after death, because God has an eternal plan for us, and he will not be short-circuited in what that plan is. And fifth, the goodness of God demands life after death, for as there's a purpose in the creation which God has made, and God is not vindictive with his creation. Now, I know there is a ball game tonight, and I admire you for being here, because I know some of you want to go as soon as you can, and I do know that some who are not here frankly told me, sorry, we won't be there until the next week, because we are either going to the game or we are going to listen to the game. Now, I am sure that there's nobody here tonight who would put the game ahead of these lectures. And yet at the same time, I am going to stop here and let you go home so you can see the rest of the game. Don't you see how kind and considerate I am? And if I am that kind and considerate with you, how much more considerate and kind will God be with us when we come to the end of the way and he takes our hands and leads us into a new world? Now, there's more I want to say. And next week, we don't have a ball game. So I will talk longer next week about some additional things which we need to share together. Thank you very much. There are books on the table. Most of the books there are about the subject which I'm talking about these days. And if you'd like to look at them, and you'd like to get some, feel free to do so. You're dismissed.